Turning to the major highlight of the evening, I would now like to introduce and welcome to the stage the Governor of the Reserve Bank, Michelle Bullock. Michelle Bullock commenced as Governor in September of this year. She is Chair of the Reserve Bank Board, the Payment System Board and the Council of Financial Regulators. Prior to her current role, she was Deputy Governor of the Reserve Bank. She's also previously held a variety of senior management positions at the bank. These have included Assistant Governor of the Financial System, Assistant Governor of Business Services, Assistant Governor of Currency, Advisor for the Currency Group, and Head of the Payments Policy Department. She has a Bachelor of Economics with Honours from the University of New England and has a postgraduate degree from the London School of Economics. Michelle has generously agreed to take questions, so I will return to moderate those questions. We have allocated 20 minutes for those questions. I welcome now Michelle to the stage.
Thank you, Bessa. I was going to say thank you very much for inviting me to AB's annual dinner, but I realised you invited Phil. And I am now what you got. I did speak as Deputy Governor last year, and little did I know that I'd be doing it again this year, but this time as Governor. So thank you very much for that. I'm going to speak about two things tonight. The first is current monetary policy, and I suspect that's what a lot of people want to hear about. But the second is going to be more future-focused, and that's the changes the Reserve Bank is implementing to our monetary policy processes, which is coming out of the review of the Reserve Bank of Australia, which I'm sure you all know about. But first, to our inflation challenge. I'm guessing I just pushed this, do I? There we go. As I'm sure you're all aware, the Reserve Bank Board raised interest rates by 25 basis points at its November meeting. This followed several months where we held rates steady. Now, an important consideration in the Board's decision was that both economic activity and inflation have been a bit more resilient over recent months than expected. Inflation is past its peak and it's heading in the right direction, but it's likely to return to target a bit more slowly than we previously thought. So as such, the Board decided that a rate rise in November at the November meeting was appropriate to be more assured that inflation returns to target in a reasonable timeframe and to balance its inflation and full employment objectives. So the minutes of the November meeting were released today and they step through the main considerations of that decision. So I'm not going to repeat those. Instead, I want to focus on one particular consideration for policy, that the remaining inflation challenge we're dealing with is increasingly homegrown and demand driven. This is actually an important point because it has implications for the appropriate policy response. If inflation is simply the product of global supply disruptions or other price rises that monetary policy has little influence over, then the appropriate response from interest rates would generally be limited. This is especially the case if inflation is driven by just a few items such as, say, fuel, electricity or rents. However, a more substantial monetary policy response, monetary policy tightening, is the right response to inflation that results from aggregate demand exceeding the economy's potential to meet that demand. And I discussed this in my speech last month. Now, it's true that supply-side disruptions were the most prominent driver of initial surge in inflation around the world in recent years. Pandemic-related supply chain problems occurred at the same time as demand for goods was strong, and that resulted in sharp increase in the prices for goods. Then, as the pandemic's effects on supply chains were starting to ease, Russia's invasion of Ukraine led to spikes in energy and some food prices. Headline inflation around the world is now declining as goods price inflation is continuing to ease, and as the energy price rises have unwound, and this process still has a little bit further to run. But many countries are observing that core services inflation is declining much more slowly. A similar trajectory in inflation has been seen in Australia, although with a slight delay compared with many other peer economies. Supply chain effects were certainly evident in goods prices, and like overseas, we are observing an easing of those pressures. The energy price impacts didn't hit us at the same time as other countries, but we also saw electricity and fuel prices rise sharply. Now, as these supply side effects wane, headline inflation will come down, and we're already observing this. But in the background, there has been a solid demand-driven component to inflation. And this shift from mainly supply-driven to mainly demand-driven inflation has been a part of our inflation outlook for some time. So there are three pieces of evidence that collectively paint a picture of a sizable demand-driven element to inflation. The first signal is that inflation is broadly based. This is evident from trim mean inflation, which remains too high and in the most recent quarter was stronger than we'd earlier expected. And if we look across the CPI basket, around two-thirds of items have inflation running above 3%. Indeed, as you can see from the graph, often a long way above that number. Inflation is lower on average for only a few items, a few volatile items, such as fresh food and holiday travel, and for some items for where government subsidies have recently been increased. So inflation is much broader than just rising prices for petrol, electricity and rents. Prices are rising strongly for the majority of goods and services we all consume. Now, the second indicator of inflation being driven by domestic demand is that it's increasingly underpinned by services. Hairdressers, dentists, dining out, sporting and other recreational activities, the prices of all these services are rising strongly. This reflects domestic economic conditions, not international, and it's an indication that aggregate demand is sufficiently greater than aggregate supply to sustain these price increases. Now, the cost of these services is also typically driven by the price of domestic inputs, since labour and domestic non-labour costs comprise most of the inputs used in supplying them. The bank's liaison with firms indicates that these domestic cost pressures are proving persistent. Labour costs have risen, especially when we incorporate the effect of weak productivity growth, and the price of domestic non-labour costs, such as energy, business rents and insurance, has increased notably. On the other hand, as you can see, imported cost pressures are starting to subside. The third signal is the continuation of limited spare capacity, and that's most evident in high rates of labour utilisation. There continues to be a clear link between services inflation and measures of spare capacity, since it's easy to raise prices when firms cannot keep up with customers' demands. We're also hearing in our business liaison with firms that capacity utilisation is very high, and various indicators of activity suggest that demand in the economy has been stronger this year than we'd expected. So we're therefore getting both a signal from inflation and activity data that the level of aggregate demand continues to exceed the level of aggregate supply. Now, an important implication of this homegrown and demand-driven component to inflation is that getting inflation back to target will take time. It took only three quarters for inflation to fall from 8% to 5.5% as the supply side issues eased, and there's still a bit more to go there. But we expect it's going to take another 2 years for inflation to fall that much again and move below 3%. This is because much of the remaining task of bringing inflation back to target will require bringing aggregate demand and aggregate supply into closer alignment. And that's what the board's aiming to do with monetary policy, to slow the growth of demand enough to bring inflation back to target while keeping employment growing. Now, I do know that my message tonight probably won't resonate with some people. I receive letters from people who are finding it difficult to make ends meet, and I speak with organisations who are assisting struggling households. Everyone is seeing prices for goods and services rise strongly, but this has a particularly severe impact on low-income households. This really emphasises the need to get inflation back down. I also know that interest rate rises are squeezing the finances of households with a mortgage. But while the board recognises that there is a wide diversity of experience, the bank's statutory objectives are economy-wide objectives, economy-wide outcomes. And our key tool, the interest rate, is, as we say, it's a blunt one. So the board must therefore set its policy to serve the welfare of Australians collectively. So I want to turn now to another focus of my speech, which is the changes the Reserve Bank is implementing to ensure our monetary policy framework is fit for the future, in the language of the review of the bank. Now, the inner workings of the bank are not normally of much interest to the public, but it is important that Australians can trust we have processes that facilitate the best possible decision-making, given the effect of our decisions on people. And there are some major changes underway to implement the recommendations from the review of the Reserve Bank. Some of these require changes to the Reserve Bank Act, and the government will be tabling that in Parliament shortly. But there is much that we can act on independently, and tonight I'm going to give you a flavour of what we're working on. I want to make it 100% clear, though, that I'm 100% behind the changes. The RBA is a great institution. It's got a long history of serving the Australian people, but as times change, we must change as well. And I think people forget that we have been through change before. Right at the beginning of my career, when I started at the bank, the exchange rate was floated and interest rates were deregulated. That was a massive change to the monetary policy framework. In the early 1990s, we adopted an inflation target. And then in the late 1990s, bank supervision was removed from the RBA's responsibility, and at the same time we were given powers to regulate the payment system. Again, really big changes. The latest review is another incarnation of change, and again, we'll embrace it and we'll emerge a stronger institution. Many of the issues raised in the review around culture and leadership are ones that I am personally very passionate about. And as a leader, I have been working on these issues in my areas of influence. Now I have an opportunity to lead this change and to model it. My vision for the bank is to be an institution of diverse perspectives and inclusive processes. I want our people to share their views, knowing that they will be listened to respectfully. I also want the bank to be open to fresh ideas from outside by increasing and diversifying our external engagements and leveraging the experience of our people who have external expertise. I want us to be an institution that communicates well both with its people and the Australian public. So tonight I'll talk about how I plan to implement that vision as it relates to monetary policy and culture. I'm going to leave a discussion of the substantial changes we're making to improve the way the bank is governed and manages risk. I'll leave that for another time. So one of my strategic priorities is to refresh our monetary policy decision-making process so that it is fit for the future in the language of the review. Now, Phil discussed at a high level in July the changes we're introducing to board processes. These involve a move to 8 board meetings a year, and we'll start that from February next year, February 24. We'll have longer board meetings. We're going to have an internal staff meeting at the beginning of the board cycle that board members will be able to attend. We're going to have board oversight of the research agenda. And we're going to make changes to communication, including the post-meeting statement being issued by the board rather than the governor, and we'll have media conferences after each meeting. Now, since that announcement, we've actually expanded and sharpened our thinking on those issues. And in doing so, we've focused on the recommendations of the review, but we've also engaged with peer central banks, and we've drawn on expertise from outside the bank. So in building out these changes, we've been mindful of 2 key aims highlighted in the review. First is providing more opportunity for the board to have deep and informed deliberation. And the second is providing a clearer explanation of monetary policy decisions to our various audiences. So the starting point, deep and informed deliberation, well, we need to allow time if we're going to do that. So the first step will involve board members attending a policy issues meeting around about 10 days before each board meeting. Now, currently, The board members received the material for the board meeting 4 days prior to the meeting, so that's a substantial increase in time. So we'll be engaging in this new process, the board members will be engaged with the policy issues earlier. This new meeting will assemble a group of staff with the right experience and expertise to give members insights and diversity of perspectives on the key issues that are relevant for policy. It'll provide analysis of issues that are relevant for a few upcoming meetings, not just the immediate meeting. For example, staff could provide deeper analysis on issues that members have been grappling with in previous meetings. They could discuss longer run issues that potentially affect monetary policy well into the future, or they could discuss topics the staff think will equip the board to consider the different options for policies, for example, scenario analysis. I envisage that members of the board would be active participants in the meeting, asking questions and requesting follow-up analysis as required. Now, the second step is to hold longer board meetings. So the meetings now will start on Monday afternoon. The discussion in the afternoon will involve presentations from staff on the state of the economy and markets, along with the outlook. This will mean that the board will spend around 3.5 hours discussing these issues. That's about twice as much as they spend now. The idea isn't for longer presentations, but for members to have more time to discuss, probe, and deepen their understanding of the issues. My own experience, actually, with current meetings is that there's never any shortage of questions. There's just a shortage of time to address them all in the meeting. So I think this will be really positive. The board will then reconvene on Tuesday morning to consider the policy decision. Now, this will have the benefit of members being able to reflect overnight, and then they can raise any further issues or questions before the policy decision is made. And we've allocated plenty of time on that day for debate and to discuss the merit of different courses of action. And then finally, the Tuesday morning will include discussion of the post-meeting communication. As I noted, the post-meeting statement will be from the board, so the members collectively will need to consider how best to explain the decision. And I'll come back to communications in a minute. So in addition to time, and deep and informed decision-making requires quality briefings. So the other change we're making is to the material we're going to provide to the board. The members consistently tell us that the board papers they receive from bank staff are among the best they receive for the boards they sit on, and they sit on a lot of boards. So we want to make sure we keep what we do really well, but we want to identify where we can do better. And the main change we intend to make here is to provide more strategic focus in the material provided to the board. So while the board's always had an eye to the future and to different policy options, we want to bring this much more to the fore in the new style papers. We're still going to discuss how the data have evolved, but there's going to be a little less of what went up and what went down over the previous couple of months. So what sort of material might I be talking about here? I envisage a greater role for scenario analysis, and that'll facilitate a discussion of risks to the outlook and the potential implications of different decisions. I also envisage a deeper discussion of trade-offs, and a consideration of how the immediate decision fits within a medium-term strategy. This sort of material will require the board to be engaged in our modelling and our forecasting frameworks, and it will require the bank to enhance its modelling capabilities, and that's another thing that we're doing. We'll also be providing the board with a summary of the views from staff to capture the diversity of their opinions. Currently, the Governor briefs the board at each meeting on the views of senior staff and highlights where there are differences of opinion. We intend to make this more structured and to draw on the full range of internal policy meetings, not just those of the most senior staff. Materials setting out in more detail the arguments raised by staff for and against particular policy options and strategies will help members better understand the full range of views. This summary of the diversity of staff views will complement the policy recommendation I make at each meeting, which the board says it values and it would like to continue. So all that said, deep and informed board decisions need to be backed up by explanations that the public can understand. And therefore, I'm going to be focusing on enhancing our communications, and there's going to be several elements to this. First, we're going to incorporate communication expertise throughout the policy development process, from the early stages of the board right up until the board's ultimate decision. Communication, as we've seen, is actually a very important tool in the conduct of monetary policy, and we want to embed it more effectively in the policy process. To achieve this, we are elevating the importance of communication within the bank with the creation of a new executive position and department. So many of you might have heard that we recently appointed Sally Cray as our Chief Communications Officer. We've been moving to more strategic communication for some time, sharing policy messages through a broader range of channels, more directly engaging with important stakeholders, and making analysis and decisions easier to understand and access. But there's more we can do, and Sally Cray will drive that. In the meantime, we have committed to a few concrete actions. We've committed to a regular media briefing an hour after the monetary policy decision is released. That'll provide an opportunity for journalists to grill me. Clarify and probe issues that have been raised in the post-meeting statement, and better equip them, I think, to analyse the decision for the public and report it in a sensible and intelligent way. We're also going to release the statement on monetary policy at the same time as the monetary policy decision every second meeting. This, I think, will be helpful because it will provide a comprehensive discussion of our reasoning and the outlook underpinning the monetary policy decision. And the look and the feel of the statement is also going to change. In time, maybe not immediately, but in time, I think you'll expect to see a shorter document, but with a clearer explanation of how we assess the economy and the outlook. And we'll also move to design features that will enable casual readers to see the relevant information more quickly. But there's much more to go, and it's going to be an iterative process. I want the bank under my leadership to be an institution that continually reflects and evolves, and the board is no different. With longer meetings, we'll have opportunities to reflect on our processes, on what sort of analysis would be helpful for upcoming meetings, and whether our communication is hitting the mark. Now, so far I've talked a lot about the changes we'll be making to our processes and outputs, but the quality of these relies on the quality of our people. The bank is really lucky to have so many talented people, and I want to bring out the best in them. But to achieve the vision I set out at the start, an institution that values and encourages diverse and inclusive perspectives, that's going to require us to focus on our culture and leadership. We've already taken a few steps here. Building on the recommendations of the review, we've identified some specific areas where our culture does not yet sufficiently encourage the kind of discussion and idea sharing that I'm looking for. These include the level of comfort our people have in challenging, particularly those more senior than them, the style and nature of our internal debate, and a perception that leaders actually don't listen to alternative views. So you'll see there's a bit of a theme there. It's leadership. We won't change the culture unless we can change leadership behaviours. So we're investing in training and support for our leaders, including our executives, to help them be more open and inclusive. And this training then needs to be put into practice. We'll be setting clear expectations, introducing ways to measure the performance of our leaders, and then holding them accountable for their contribution to the vision. And I also need to set an example. I'm encouraging more active debate and challenge than we've seen in the past, including of my own views, in a respectful and constructive manner. To make my commitment to creating a diverse and inclusive workplace where everyone feels they belong, to make clear my commitment to that, I have actually decided to stay on as the chair of the bank's Diversity and Inclusion Council. And this is a role that, from its inception, has been held by the Deputy Governor, but I want to elevate it. Changing culture takes time, but I know our staff are committed to making the bank as effective as it can be, and I am confident we will see material change over the coming years. And I really hope that it'll be visible to everyone outside the bank as well. So in conclusion, the coming year is going to be challenging for the bank on two fronts. We still have to bring inflation back down to target while preserving as much of the gains made in the labour market over the past few years as possible. We're still seeking to tread that narrow path that Phil talked about. At the same time, we're changing our monetary policy processes and improving our culture. And while I haven't talked about it tonight, there's also substantial work underway to change our governance and uplift our risk management. But despite this large workload, I consistently hear from the bank's staff that they support these changes, and I am confident that we will all meet this challenge. So thank you for listening, and I look forward to your questions.
Thanks, Michelle, for the update on the recent decision and also the review of the RBA and the changes underway. There are two microphones in the room, one to the left and one to the right, so if you'd like to ask a question, please line up. We've got 20 minutes for questions, so I know last time I did have to cut off people, so I'm just letting you know in advance that that might happen again. So what I would ask is for those of you asking questions, if you can just keep them succinct, because then we can get through more questions. Let's start with the left.
Thanks, Michelle. David Orsman from Macquarie University. Great speech, but more importantly, what a terrific set of ways of enhancing the bank that's been embraced by yourself and also within the bank. It's really wonderful to hear that sort of stuff. In a nutshell, what you're really doing is bringing more of the uncertainty of how the future looks, the diversity of viewpoints and so forth, into the decision making, particularly at the highest levels. But the challenge we have as a reserve, as a bank, a central bank, is holding the credibility of the public within that large fog of uncertainty. I mean, if you had put up the fan charts in your inflation forecast, they wouldn't look as impressive as the single lines that are going down. And I wonder what your thoughts are about within this process of getting more diversity and more uncertainties and more questions of how do we hold the public's credibility, knowing that the public is less informed than the experts, that in fact this is the right pathway forward within that uncertainty.
Thanks, David. You've basically hit upon the communication challenge. The review noted that we hadn't communicated as well as we could have. I think we have attempted to communicate very well in the past with the financial markets and the media, but we've had less success, I think, at communicating with the public, and I think that's our challenge. So one of the jobs of Sally when she starts at the bank is to think about ways that we can get our messages out in a digestible way to the Australian public. That I think, is our real challenge, because I don't think we've really hit the mark there yet. So I think you've hit upon something that we're just going to have to work hard on.
Let's go to Tapas from NAB.
Thank you, Governor Bullock. Tavis Strickland from National Australia Bank. I really enjoyed the speech and really appreciate that you're taking on 100% of the review recommendations. Just in regards to the review recommendations, one of them was to target or communicate about the midpoint of the inflation target. I was wondering if you could explore your thoughts on that, and just in the context that when I speak to offshore clients, they ask whether the RBA is actually running a 3% cap, because the communication is all about getting back to the top of the inflation target by the end of 2025.
Thanks. Yes, the recommendation was to aim for the middle of the target, and that is in fact what we will be aiming for. And when a new statement on the conduct of monetary policy comes out, and I think that might be before the end of the year, then that will be reflected in that statement. So that should help to give the international community some confidence that in fact we are not just aiming to get to the cap, that we are in fact aiming to get to the midpoint. But the strength of our system has always been that we've had a little bit of flexibility to address uncertainty, shocks, those sorts of things. That's always been the advantage, I think, of our system. And so We're not sort of just saying, well, if we get back down to 3, that'll be good enough, because it doesn't give you much leeway on the upside. So I think that will become clear once the statement on the conduct monetary policy comes out.
Thank you.
Let's go.
Thank you, Governor. Jonathan McManaman from Barrenjoey. My question is, I suppose, about that demand side that you were talking about. In the effort, you know, raising rates, you're trying to slow demand at the moment. How do you think about the very high level of population growth that we've got at the moment, and how do you overcome that, given where we are in the cycle, and interested in your thoughts in that area?
Sure. So a lot of people have made quite a deal about the fact that per capita consumption is declining, but aggregate consumption is still rising, obviously, slowly. What people often don't realise is that, well, they may forget, I think, is that the increased population also adds to supply. And I think our judgment is that, yes, there is a bit of adding to inflationary pressures from demand, but at the same time, the increase in the population is adding to supply of labour, and that's helping on the demand side, on the demand-supply imbalance in the labour market as well. So it's not clear-cut that immigration is just simply causing lots of inflation. Sure, you can point to housing and rents as being one particular area where there's a particular bottleneck, but I think it's a subtler argument than that, and I think we would argue, and I think we've probably said it in our statement on monetary policy, that actually if you take into account what it's doing on the supply side, it's not clear that it's adding heaps to inflationary pressures. Thanks.
Paul?
Paul Bloxham, HSBC. Thank you for your speech, Governor. As you set out, the task is to either slow down aggregate demand or get aggregate supply to catch up in order to get inflation down. One of the fundamental errors that central banks made through the pandemic is that they didn't really understand the supply side well enough, and that's why the inflation shock came along in the end. So you spoke a lot about the idea that you are tracking aggregate demand and it's still running strongly, but where is the evidence that the supply side is going to be sufficiently flexible to allow the inflation to get back to target over the horizon you've described, and in particular for that to happen and still see an unemployment rate that only lifts a little bit, lifts to by under one percentage point over this cycle and still gets inflation down? What should we be looking for in terms of evidence that the supply side is actually proving to be as flexible?
Turning to the major highlight of the evening, I would now like to introduce and welcome to the stage the Governor of the Reserve Bank, Michelle Bullock. Michelle Bullock commenced as Governor in September of this year. She is Chair of the Reserve Bank Board, the Payment System Board and the Council of Financial Regulators. Prior to her current role, she was Deputy Governor of the Reserve Bank. She's also previously held a variety of senior management positions at the bank. These have included Assistant Governor of the Financial System, Assistant Governor of Business Services, Assistant Governor of Currency, Advisor for the Currency Group and Head of the Payments Policy Department. She has a Bachelor of Economics with Honours from the University of New England and has a postgraduate degree from the London School of Economics. Michelle has generously agreed to take questions, so I will return to moderate those questions. We have allocated 20 minutes for those questions. I welcome now Michelle to the stage.
Thank you, Besser. I was going to say thank you very much for inviting me to AB's annual dinner, but I realised you invited Phil. And I am now what you got. I did speak as Deputy Governor last year, and little did I know that I'd be doing it again this year, but this time as Governor. So thank you very much for that. I'm going to speak about two things tonight. The first is current monetary policy, and I suspect that's what a lot of people want to hear about. But the second is going to be more future-focused, and that's the changes the Reserve Bank is implementing to our monetary policy processes, which is coming out of the review of the Reserve Bank of Australia, which I'm sure you all know about. But first, to our inflation challenge. I'm guessing I just push this, do I? There we go. As I'm sure you're all aware, the Reserve Bank Board raised interest rates by 25 basis points at its November meeting. This followed several months where we held rates steady. Now, an important consideration in the Board's decision was that both economic activity and inflation have been a bit more resilient over recent months than expected. Inflation is past its peak and it's heading in the right direction, but it's likely to return to target a bit more slowly than we previously thought. So as such, the Board decided that a rate rise in November at the November meeting was appropriate to be more assured that inflation returns to target in a reasonable timeframe and to balance its inflation and full employment objectives. So the minutes of the November meeting were released today and they step through the main considerations of that decision. So I'm not going to repeat those. Instead, I want to focus on one particular consideration for policy, that the remaining inflation challenge we're dealing with is increasingly homegrown and demand-driven. This is actually an important point because it has implications for the appropriate policy response. If inflation is simply the product of global supply disruptions or other price rises that monetary policy has little influence over, then the appropriate response from interest rates would generally be limited. This is especially the case if inflation is driven by just a few items such as, say, fuel, electricity or rents. However, a more substantial monetary policy response, monetary policy tightening, is the right response to inflation that results from aggregate demand exceeding the economy's potential to meet that demand. And I discussed this in my speech last month. Now, it's true that supply-side disruptions were the most prominent driver of initial surge in inflation around the world in recent years. Pandemic-related supply chain problems occurred at the same time as demand for goods was strong, and that resulted in sharp increase in the prices for goods. Then, as the pandemic's effects on supply chains were starting to ease, Russia's invasion of Ukraine led to spikes in energy and some food prices. Headline inflation around the world is now declining as goods price inflation is continuing to ease, and as the energy price rises have unwound, and this process still has a little bit further to run. But many countries are observing that core services inflation is declining much more slowly. So a similar trajectory in inflation has been seen in Australia, although with a slight delay compared with many other peer economies. Supply chain effects were certainly evident in goods prices, and like overseas, we are observing an easing of those pressures. The energy price impacts didn't hit us at the same time as other countries, but we also saw electricity and fuel prices rise sharply. Now, as these supply side effects wane, headline inflation will come down, and we're already observing this. But in the background, there has been a solid demand-driven component to inflation. And this shift from mainly supply-driven to mainly demand-driven inflation has been a part of our inflation outlook for some time. So there are three pieces of evidence that collectively paint a picture of a sizable demand-driven element to inflation. The first signal is that inflation is broadly based. This is evident from trim mean inflation, which remains too high and in the most recent quarter was stronger than we'd earlier expected. And if we look across the CPI basket, around two-thirds of items have inflation running above 3%. Indeed, as you can see from the graph, often a long way above that number. Inflation is lower on average for only a few items, a few volatile items, such as fresh food and holiday travel, and for some items for where government subsidies have recently been increased. So inflation is much broader than just rising prices for petrol, electricity and rents. Prices are rising strongly for the majority of goods and services we all consume. Now, the second indicator of inflation being driven by domestic demand is that it's increasingly underpinned by services. Hairdressers, dentists, dining out, sporting and other recreational activities, the prices of all these services are rising strongly. This reflects domestic economic conditions, not international, and it's an indication that aggregate demand is sufficiently greater than aggregate supply to sustain these price increases. Now, the cost of these services is also typically driven by the price of domestic inputs, since labour and domestic non-labour costs comprise most of the inputs used in supplying them. The bank's liaison with firms indicates that these domestic cost pressures are proving persistent. Labour costs have risen, especially when we incorporate the effect of weak productivity growth, and the price of domestic non-labour costs, such as energy, business rents and insurance, has increased notably. On the other hand, as you can see, imported cost pressures are starting to subside. The third signal is the continuation of limited spare capacity, and that's most evident in high rates of labour utilisation. There continues to be a clear link between services inflation and measures of spare capacity, since it's easy to raise prices when firms cannot keep up with customers' demands. We're also hearing in our business liaison with firms that capacity utilisation is very high, and various indicators of activity suggest that demand in the economy has been stronger this year than we'd expected. So we're therefore getting both a signal from inflation and activity data that the level of aggregate demand continues to exceed the level of aggregate supply. Now, an important implication of this homegrown and demand-driven component to inflation is that getting inflation back to target will take time. It took only three quarters for inflation to fall from 8% to 5.5% as the supply-side issues eased, and there's still a bit more to go there. But we expect it's going to take another 2 years for inflation to fall that much again and move below 3%. This is because much of the remaining task of bringing inflation back to target will require bringing aggregate demand and aggregate supply into closer alignment. And that's what the board's aiming to do with monetary policy, to slow the growth of demand enough to bring inflation back to target while keeping employment growing. Now, I do know that my message tonight probably won't resonate with some people. I receive letters from people who are finding it difficult to make ends meet, and I speak with organisations who are assisting struggling households. Everyone is seeing prices for goods and services rise strongly, but this has a particularly severe impact on low-income households. This really emphasises the need to get inflation back down. I also know that interest rate rises are squeezing the finances of households with a mortgage. But while the board recognises that there is a wide diversity of experience, the bank's statutory objectives are economy-wide outcomes. And our key tool, the interest rate, is, as we say, it's a blunt one. So the board must therefore set its policy to serve the welfare of Australians collectively. So I want to turn now to another focus of my speech, which is the changes the Reserve Bank is implementing to ensure our monetary policy framework is fit for the future, in the language of the review of the bank. Now, the inner workings of the bank are not normally of much interest to the public, but it is important that Australians can trust we have processes that facilitate the best possible decision-making, given the effect of our decisions on people. And there are some major changes underway to implement the recommendations from the review of the Reserve Bank. Some of these require changes to the Reserve Bank Act, and the government will be tabling that in Parliament shortly. But there is much that we can act on independently, and tonight I'm going to give you a flavour of what we're working on. I want to make it 100% clear, though, that I'm 100% behind the changes. The RBA is a great institution. It's got a long history of serving the Australian people, but as times change, we must change as well. And I think people forget that we have been through change before. Right at the beginning of my career, when I started at the bank, the exchange rate was floated and interest rates were deregulated. That was a massive change to the monetary policy framework. in the early 1990s, we adopted an inflation target. And then in the late 1990s, bank supervision was removed from the RBA's responsibility, and at the same time we were given powers to regulate the payment system. Again, really big changes. The latest review is another incarnation of change, and again, we'll embrace it and we'll emerge a stronger institution. Many of the issues raised in the review around culture and leadership are ones that I am personally very passionate about. And as a leader, I have been working on these issues in my areas of influence. Now I have an opportunity to lead this change and to model it. My vision for the bank is to be an institution of diverse perspectives and inclusive processes. I want our people to share their views, knowing that they will be listened to respectfully. I also want the bank to be open to fresh ideas from outside by increasing and diversifying our external engagements and leveraging the experience of our people who have external expertise. I want us to be an institution that communicates well both with its people and the Australian public. So tonight I'll talk about how I plan to implement that vision as it relates to monetary policy and culture. I'm going to leave a discussion of the substantial changes we're making to improve the way the bank is governed and manages risk. I'll leave that for another time. So one of my strategic priorities is to refresh our monetary policy decision-making process so that it is fit for the future in the language of the review. Now, Phil discussed at a high level in July the changes we're introducing to board processes. These involve a move to 8 board meetings a year, and we'll start that from February next year, February 24. We'll have longer board meetings. We're going to have an internal staff meeting at the beginning of the board cycle that board members will be able to attend. We're going to have board oversight of the research agenda. And we're going to make changes to communication, including the post-meeting statement being issued by the board rather than the governor, and we'll have media conferences after each meeting. Now, since that announcement, we've actually expanded and sharpened our thinking on those issues. And in doing so, we've focused on the recommendations of the review, but we've also engaged with peer central banks, and we've drawn on expertise from outside the bank. So in building out these changes, we've been mindful of two key aims highlighted in the review. First is providing more opportunity for the board to have deep and informed deliberation, and the second is providing a clearer explanation of monetary policy decisions to our various audiences. So the starting point, deep and informed deliberation, well, we need to allow time if we're going to do that. So the first step will involve board members attending a policy issues meeting around about 10 days before each board meeting. Now, currently, the board members receive the material for the board meeting 4 days prior to the meeting. So that's a substantial increase in time. So we'll be engaging in this new process. The board members will be engaged with the policy issues earlier. This new meeting will assemble a group of staff with the right experience and expertise to give members insights and diversity of perspectives on the key issues that are relevant for policy. It'll provide analysis of issues that are relevant for a few upcoming meetings, not just the immediate meeting. For example, staff could provide deeper analysis on issues that members have been grappling with in previous meetings. They could discuss longer run issues, that potentially affect monetary policy well into the future, or they could discuss topics the staff think will equip them.